Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. This is where top performers share their secrets to help you achieve your personal and your professional goals. I am your host, Denise Griffiths, and together with my amazing guests, we bring you inspiring and actionable insights to take your life and your business to the next level. Ranked in the top 2% globally, this podcast really is a must listen. And again, it's because of my guests. So whether you're tuning in for entrepreneurial tips, career advice, or personal development strategies, get ready to turn inspiration into action, challenges into triumphs, and dreams into reality. So in this episode, we're going to be diving into project managing essentials with Corey Kogan, who brings a wealth of experience as Franklin Covey's Vice President of Content and Senior Consultant. Corey is a co-author of The 5 Choices, The Path to Extraordinary Productivity, and has been featured on Today, MSNBC's Your Business, I think that's it, Forbes, Inc.com, and FastCompany.com. I was reading and talking at the same time. That doesn't always work well. So with over 25 years of varied business experience, she's more than well equipped to discuss the ins and the outs of effective project management. And I have her book, Project Management for the Unofficial Project Manager, the updated and revised edition, on my desk as we speak. So throughout our conversation this morning, Corey will shed light on the common pitfalls that lead to project failure, the core principles that underpin successful project management, and the 5 crucial phases necessary for project success. Corey, welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. It's good to have you, and thank you for sending me the book.
Oh, Denise, thanks for having me, and I'm so glad you, and honored that you have the book right there in front of you, but a pleasure to be here today.
Not only do I have it in front of me, I read it. People are like, when do you have time to read? I don't watch TV. You give me a book, I'm all happy. You give me a remote and I'm like, what do you want me to do with this? So I've read it. It's got sticky notes in it. It's fat. I don't mark up books. I just don't. Remember when we would go to the library as kids and we were warned, do not damage this book. It's still in my head. So I've got sticky notes. I've got index cards. I've read this book. So thank you.
Welcome.
So tell us about you.
Well, you gave a little bit of a bio. I born and raised in New York City. I'll get my accent out of the way. But I live in Tucson, Arizona, and have been with Franklin Covey for unbelievably in the teens of years. At the time is just flying, and honored to serve, as you mentioned, as VP of Content Development. So I have the opportunity to architect a lot of our work around leadership and productivity. A lot of people call me a thought leader and a subject matter expert. And that's where I draw the line, because I am much more of a laboratory rat as a leader out in the field than a subject matter expert. So I use a lot of my street knowledge to inform the kind of work that you have in front of you and some of the other things that we do. So that's a little bit about me.
I love that. You're a lab rat. You said that to me in the pre-interview, and I cracked up that time too. So apparently it really tickles me for some reason. In the introduction on page 1, literally, it says, so you're an unofficial project manager. And we talked a bit about that too. Go down that rabbit hole for me, would you?
Well, yeah. We are knowledge workers, and for the most part, whether you're a small business, a large business, even if you work in manufacturing and all of that, you're on a factory floor, we're all in one way or another paid to think, innovate, create, and execute. So contrast that with the industrial age, where We were paid to not think and just, you know, do 10 widgets, don't talk. And if you do 9, we'll let you go and get somebody else that'll do 10. So in the old days, you know, and it was a great time in the industrial age, but in the old days, it really was the optimization of manual labor. And today, it really is the optimization of mental labor because we use our brain to do all of that work. So we're paid to make things. And that even became more apparent over the last few years when the pandemic hit and we all, you know, scurried home and all of our systems changed and we had to make new things and think up new things and all of that. And so over the last number of years, including the last few where it really showed up, we've all slipped into this role where our main job mostly is making things, making a marketing campaign, making a sales process, making a, you know, an L&D project, making a podcast production. Those are things with a beginning and an end. And we as knowledge workers have unofficially slipped into the role of project management. Official project managers have a lot of training around process and how to do that well. We just do it based on our smarts and our talents, which leads me to my second name for myself is that I am a scarred unofficial project manager because very talented people get things done, but there can be an easier way. And when people realize they're unofficial project managers and they realize that we can help make that journey easier of creating things with a beginning and end, it's like, hooray, let's do it. And it's why this book has been so popular, actually.
And I remember you telling me that it wasn't necessarily these days and everything you're talking about, you don't necessarily have to have that degree or those certifications. We're already doing a lot of what you're talking about.
Well, and that's, yes, those are the official project managers. So people may know the Project Management Institute, which we are associated with and aligned to. And, if, you know, the official project managers are the engineers and others. You don't have to be an engineer, but they are, you know, certified. It's a very detailed, you know, process. And for unofficial project managers, what we're able to do is take the best of the real application of what has to happen and distill that down into viable, good learning for people like us. You don't need the certification. You're welcome to it. But for those of us that are doing the types of things that I mentioned, we probably don't need that level of certification. And most of the people that I talk to, including myself, I don't have project manager on my business card or in my title, but 80, 90% of my time is I'm working on these big things for Franklin Covey, developing all of the work that we and the product that we put out there.
Exactly. And I was thinking about you a couple of days ago because I was poking around through a couple of Facebook groups, a podcasting one in particular, and another one for social media marketing. You know, I'm always curious to see what people are thinking, what they're up to, what have they discovered that's new and great, and what are they doing that just makes me go, what the heck were you thinking? It's entertainment for me.
I get it.
But I'm reading a lot, particularly in the social media world, that I don't have certifications. I don't have this. I don't have that. And they're just stomping themselves to death. And I just want to say, and I will start saying, go get this book. Stop it.
Yeah. And that's, you know, maybe that's another podcast. I have some deep feelings about that and just my own personal journey. I don't have a lot of letters. I don't have any letters after my name. I've worked, and I say to some people, I grew up on the streets of New York. I had a mother in particular, but my parents, you know, and everybody has a different thing, really wanted me to be out in New York City, really, and that doesn't preclude any place else in the country, but they really wanted me to get out and get experience and do the work. And I was one of those people where the work became even more educational for me than additional certifications and, you know, all of that. And I started out as pre-med, which was the funniest thing in forensic medicine, go figure, before it was, you know, really popular. Having said that, I'm one of those people that I don't have a lot of certifications. Not that people shouldn't go for them, but there, when you can take systems and processes and simplify them down so that everyday people can really show that they can do something with it, that I think is really what's important. You don't have to fret that you can't get the certification. You can get the learning and be and have and show your talent. Let your talent be observable, and good things will happen.
Listen, I agree with you, and it's so important that the people who are listening to us say, you know, I know all of these things. I am a project manager. I am a knowledge worker. Why am I beating myself up? So start making a list, I guess, of the things that you can do, that you already do, and maybe where you can upskill, and go get busy.
We call that working in your circle of influence. There's the things that you can't control out there. There's a lot of things that you can. And I can't say it any better than you did. Go roll your sleeves up, do what you can, and, you know, and get busy and stop just thinking about it.
Well, you can't beat yourself up for something that and you'll be in the coffee break and, oh, I've got this and I've got that. Okay, I got better. Just be proud of yourself. But I think what I'm really trying to say is be aware of how you're showing up in the world. Be aware of the actual work that you're doing. Sometimes we have to sit down and, you know, do a pro and con list and figure out where we stand, because it's so easy to overlook it. But at the end of the day, you're like, oh God, I'm tired. You don't even give yourself a big pat on the back for the tremendous work you did.
Right. And, you know, we can go into the whole neuroscience on that as well. But we all, don't we do that? It's like we could get 100 compliments and then there's one thing somebody says, oh, well, not so much. And forget about the 100 compliments. We zero right in on that negative. And it's just part of being the human condition. And we need to really do brain muscle work to not allow ourselves to do that. We use the term acknowledge. And as leaders can help people with this to say, hey, listen, you know, don't beat yourself up. Last year, when you worked on this other project, you did an amazing job on this particular thing. How would you use that experience to help inform this experience? And when that's done, when somebody helps you do that, or you even do that to yourself, like, wait a minute, last year I worked on something and, you know, I did this part right. Your whole psyche changes, your endorphins come back. And that overwhelming feeling of shame, which is a word I like to raise because I think that's what happens, sort of gets tamped down and we're able to move forward. So acknowledging where I've done things well in the future can, in the past, can be a safeguard to get me out of the doldrums and be more proactive moving forward.
Exactly. And I've had to teach myself to write things down at night, you know, kind of look back at my day this morning. It was at 2 o'clock in the morning when I wrote that list down. I pulled kind of an all-nighter, but I almost forgot. I was tired. I needed to go try to sleep. And I went, whoa, 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 whoa. You've worked hard all day. What did you genuinely accomplish? What was great? And, you know, don't worry about what still needs to be done. That list has already been made. But what were the high points of my day? And I was able to go, oh, good girl. It made me all happy.
That's we say, you know, you mentioned the book, The Five Choices to Extraordinary Productivity. And people will say, well, what do you mean by extraordinary? I don't want to be extraordinary. And, you know, we're not talking about you have to solve world peace, although that would be a wonderful thing right now. But our definition of extraordinary is that you go to bed at night feeling like you got even just a few things done really well. And sometimes it does, Denise, take that moment at night because it's the first flying all day long. And to be able to say, no, wait, you know, I did this and I did that and I did it with quality. I kissed my kids goodnight. I'm good. And I can get a good night's sleep, which it doesn't sound like you did last night. I don't hear anything. Lou.
Oh, I'm sorry. I lost you there.
We're back.
Yeah, I have to do that. I have to have those those moments at night before I do go to sleep, because if I don't, I wake up the next morning going, what the heck? I'm grumbly. I'm thinking about drinking coffee. I hate coffee. But I don't want to wake up like that. So I woke up this morning, go, ooh, I am ready to kick some fanny. And then here you are helping me kick fanny. So I'm all kinds of happy right now. So I wanted to ask you, because you talk about we're all project managers now, and I completely understand that. But when you get to page five, it says, why this book? Let's talk about that. Why this book?
Well, it's a lot of what we said, so far. I mean, unofficial project managers need some place to go, but I'll tell you why this book is because it's not as people are sitting there buckling their seatbelt, thinking, okay, I'll read this book, but boy, it's going to be so technical and so, I can. They're just imagining something, and it's a light, easy book. But it's not overly technical and comprehensive. And it's sort of what I said. We've taken the world of really sort of official project management and distilled it, and distilled it to pull out those things that are key for us logically to be able to do, or complete projects well and on time. The other thing is that this book also has stories in it of real people. So it's almost has novel a novel feel to it with some of the stories. We'll meet some of the characters like Hedda and Fen and Olivia, and as they're trying to work through their projects. So it's just an easy book to read. It's not, 500 pages long, and the way it's told in story will allow you to really get a good education around it as well. And it's also, when we talk about the update, it's taken the best of a couple of different types of project management, some of the older project management process, some of the new. So it's really up to date and relatable to today's workplace.
It's an easy read. And like I say, I'm a voracious reader. I'll read anything. I'll read the back of a cereal box. But I picked this up and I got on my couch with a cat on my chest and I read the entire book. It didn't take long. The most time it took was to reach over and grab my sticky notes. It was like, give me, cat, move. But it really, to me, it was a fascinating read because, I mean, you're talking about so many different things. You're talking about organizing the processes that takes best practices from both traditional, which you just mentioned, agile project management. You even talk about integrating agile and waterfall methodologies.
Yes. And again, the Project Management Institute, which again, for those that are not in the know, is like the largest, institute or association for project management. And it's how the official project managers get certified. So we follow their PMBOK, which is their standards, and they switched from PMBOK 6 to PMBOK 7, not switched, but updated, and made this big move from more of a waterfall, which I'll explain, process, and they really opened it up to agile. And that's a whole interesting story too, about 12 years ago, and just sort of this uprising against some of the strident methodologies around project management and how we needed to be more agile and more nimble in making sure that the project is bringing intended value. So we took the best of both of the old and the new again and distilled it down into something really reasonable for our people meaning unofficial project managers, to be able to do really good work.
Can we talk about the differences between agile and waterfall? Because I'm not entirely sure, honestly, that I understand what they are.
Yeah, and I'll make it really simple for everybody. Generally, waterfall project management, if you think about building a bridge, which is not what unofficial project managers do, but if you think about building a bridge, that is very clear that step, you know, I need to do step one, you know, before step two. I need to get, you know, put the holes down in the ocean. I need to get the concrete. I need to put the pillars. I need to. So, waterfall, if you just even can imagine a spreadsheet like that, it's like this step and then this step and then this step. And there's very little slack in there for doing anything different. So I am scoping the project from the very beginning, getting all the information that I need, and I will deliver the project exactly the way we said from the very beginning. That's waterfall. One step falls from the other one. In Agile, particularly with the onset of our software cloud world, what was happening is we would create or create a project and hand it over to the client, and then the client will say, "Well, wait, you know, I need it differently. You know, you missed this, you missed that," and there was a lot of rework, and you know, we'd have to start over, and there's all kinds of statistics about projects, you know, project failure, and that they didn't meet the scope or the value that was intended. So back to what Agile is. Agile is scoping the project and being open to or understanding that value is number one, that always asking along the way, are we providing value in the project that we're doing to the end stakeholders and to the reason for the project? And so generally, we are more open to stopping along the way, checking in, feedback loops, and getting some client feedback. So if you've ever heard the term sprints, that's what happens. We're going to do a sprint of work, we're going to stop, get feedback, make adjustments, do another sprint, keep going. So what happens is all of the feedback has been coming in while the project is in motion. So you are pretty much guaranteed when you deliver the project, you are delivering it at the highest level of value with very little additional feedback necessary. A lot of this, people know Agile from the software, you know, industry, because again, you're writing code, you can stop, you can change code along the way. And if you think about even with creating for me an L&D program, right? A training program, instead of like, okay, this is a scope, let's go. The scope along the way, we'll check in with key stakeholders. They will tell us, maybe we should do it this way. And so we are building value all the way through to the end in an agile kind of way. And the last thing I'll say is we are also at the same time doing it in a way that we are avoiding scope creep. So that's another category where it's like, well, if you keep getting everybody's feedback, it's going to turn into a monster. That is taken into consideration in how we do this to make sure that we are agile, we are nimble, and the end product is exactly what the customer needs. So
You
that's
just
the difference.
said scope creep, and I shuddered. I couldn't help it. It's a bugaboo for so many of us.
Yes.
And you're talking basically in chapter three, scoping the project. And you said the goal is clarify a shared and measurable set of expectations. And I love this. You said try an experiment, blindfold some people, take them to a park, and ask them to walk forward in a straight line. What happens? They walk in circles. Yep, invariably. So, scope creep is that happens. Anyway, sensitivity to initial conditions. When you're scoping, the most important part of the five steps of project management, what do you need to do from there?
Well, and I that line is so profound because, like, what sensitivity to initial conditions? And so that point is, if you do not scope this right, and as it says in the book, if you start 1 degree off course on a flight from Sydney to London, I just got back from London yesterday, actually, you might end up in Rio instead. Right. And that's so, and the same is true with a project. So we have, and I can tell you horror stories of people that I've talked to and my own situations as well, where they couldn't quite get the key stakeholders to agree to a scope. And I have, as a scarred unofficial project manager, have learned that if you can't get people on the same page, you have to have the courage to stop what you're doing because you have no choice but to end up in Rio when you really wanted to go to London. It's like a principle that you will never, never get over. And so scoping is foundational, and we need to do it really, really well.
And you say in here that you've got to make sure that everybody sees the same picture of your project's outcome. That's a problem. And I'm not sure why it's a problem. I see it all the time. Is it because of poor scoping?
Well, I think it starts with how even people think about outcome. So even as we go through this, chapter and we talk about, because we talk about key stakeholders, doing a good key stakeholder interview. And one of the things that we say in here is we're going to teach you how to ask good questions. But if we're going to ask you, if we're going to teach you how to ask good questions, you better know what answers you're looking for first. So even to that end, well, what outcome are you looking for? And somebody says, well, or why is this project important? And you say, well, senior leadership thinks it's important. Well, okay. Well, that's not quite an outcome. You need to ask better questions. Well, why do they think it's important? Well, because this event is going to affect, our employee engagement, and we are hoping to increase that by 10%. Okay, now we're getting somewhere. So it's how do we understand what we even mean by an outcome, and how are we getting an outcome that's lean and mean that everybody can understand, and we strip out any of the biases or assumptions based on the interpretation of the words people are saying.
I'm a web developer by trade, and I run into this all the time. People say, oh, I want this and this and this and this and this. And during the consultation, I start asking those questions. They don't need anywhere near what they thought they needed, but I will always tell them, listen, before we start anything, before I even agree to work with you, I want you to, in your mind or on paper, walk yourself into your website. What do you see? Where does it go? What calls to action? What are you asking people to do? What are you providing? That's a whole different mindset. They're like, oh, you mean I can't copy somebody else's website? No, you cannot. I won't do it for you. But once you set them, or I have found, once I say, go into it, go in from the front door. You're a customer, you're a client, go in that front door. What do you see? And if you're not finding everything you need almost immediately, let's start over.
That was a poetic listening to that because you were scoping and you were truly getting in inside that person's head and heart. Because what I frequently will say, based on a fun exercise that we do, but I will clearly say that words are only the code by which you are describing the picture in your head. And that comes back from the days of neurolinguistics and how that works. So words are only the code by which you're describing the picture in your head. And when people understand that, whether you're asking the questions or giving the answers, that's what you are doing. You are making them feel what they want their website to be so that you can decode what's in their head that they haven't been able to articulate. And that is the art and science in for so many situations, whether you're a coach or a project manager. That's a talent to be able to do that, and it's a skill that can be learned when you understand we need to decode what's in somebody's head and heart and not make any assumptions. And you will help yourself, and more importantly, help them come to clarity.
Oh, I agree with you. And I tend to think in pictures. I think most people do. And if I can convince them that they need to go into their mind and see the whole thing, it doesn't exist yet, but it can exist in pictures. And
Yeah.
once they go, oh, everything breaks open.
Yeah, and Dr. Covey had interesting when in the Seven Habits when he talks about begin with the end in mind. He said there's two creations. One is sort of the, you know, what's in your mind? What do you see? You know, what does it look like to you? And the second one is getting it down on paper. You know, you can envision what the website might look. You need to envision what the website needs to look like, being led by the types of questions that you asked. And then the second creation is now let's get the wireframe going.
Exactly. And it's, I mean, I am not saying don't go look at other people's work.
Right.
Absolutely. You're going to pick up good ideas. You're going to pick up some, oh, I'm never doing that kind of thing ideas. But don't expect to copy it. It needs to be you. It needs to be your work. It needs to come from your brain, your heart, your soul. If it doesn't, I'm not entirely sure what you're doing.
Yeah, they need to have a clear end in mind, and I know you ask these questions. What do you want this website, you know, to do for you? What does success look like? And that this is taking us back to the real outcomes here. But somebody's got to be really clear on what they expect as a result of it. And I think you know this, Denise. You know, it's you know, we build things like, oh no, a website. Boy, I don't know. It's going to get me a lot of business. It,
No, it's not.
that's not a good enough answer.
Exactly. You've got work to do. That's a whole nother topic. But yeah, it's, and I love that we're talking about this. You know, get into your head, see what you need to see, and then take those same skills that you have on your own and talk with your stakeholders. Because if you can't get everybody at least close to the same picture, what are you going to do? You're going to have a big old mess on your hands.
Like I said, I have horror stories of that. And recently, candidly, on one of my, you know, projects, I stopped everything, said, okay, you know, anything else we do right now is going to be a bit of a waste unless we hammer through, you know, I don't have to be right, you don't have to be right, but we have to find what is the right thing so that we can make progress here. And again, I'm at a high level in my organization. There's people you know, listening to this that I know are saying, well, I'm not a vice president. I'm just somebody trying to get my job done, and I'm unofficially managing. And they have a lot of fear around two things. One, pushing a little bit when on key stakeholders, when they do disagree. So we cover that pretty heavily because, as the project manager, it is your responsibility, knowing how painful it's going to be if you don't get everybody on the same page, that you do need to convene them in some way to have the conversation and facilitate the discussion about how we're going to get on the same page. And as a project manager, you can do this respectfully, and you have the power to do this. And a lot of times we feel like we don't. And the second thing that project managers deal with when it comes to key stakeholders, that they have said to me, well, Corey, I don't I'm you know I don't want to ask a lot of questions because they're going to think I don't know how to do my job. And I'm like, are you kidding me? How, you can't create that website, you can't create that learning program unless you know what's in their heads. So it is okay. Now I'm a senior, you know, executive. I started this off with you by saying I was born and raised in New York City. Not to stereotype myself, but I've had to work really hard at my directness and all of that. And so people may be a little intimidated by me, which frustrates me sometimes because I really am a pussycat, but I have to work at showing that, you know, I guess more than some. So when somebody comes to me and says, listen, I have some questions about this project that's going to help increase our engagement levels by 10%. Do you have a few minutes? When you come to me like that, I'm like, oh man, I'm in. I have a few minutes for you. But if somebody came to me and said, Corey, I'm working on a project. I'm not sure what they're trying to do yet, but can I ask you some questions? I'm like, no, I don't have time for you. So, you know, project managers at any level, whether you're an individual contributor or a new leader, you have every right to go to key stakeholders. They will make time for you, even if they're at the highest levels of the organization, providing you're coming to them with a great, clear, concrete story.
And here we're talking about essential people management skills. And
Right.
you just outlined a few. Do you have a few more that you can share?
Well, yes, because what I'll give is sort of this framework that we start with, because we covered, this combination waterfall agile. And so for us, and very Franklin Covey, is we always have an overarching mindset to get us going. And the overarching mindset, because you sort of have to have some buy-in, like, okay, I get that. So what do I do? What are the behaviors I need? So we say that project success equals value, which I talked about before, plus people, plus a process. So you and I have reached the people part, and there are behaviors that are essential to leading projects. Now, I just want to say to you, a lot of people, and I'm sure there's some on this podcast, who are leading projects that never wanted to be leaders. We see that in organizations. Nope, I don't want to lead. I don't want to be at leadership. I'll go on the technical track or the genius track, it's called in some, and that's it. And then I manage projects, and suddenly it's all about the people again. And that's not where I wanted to be. But project success is value plus people plus process. So we need people who really want to play on your team and want to win. And we call that informal authority. You don't have the title, maybe. You're an individual contributor running a project, but you need some skills. Now, there are a million, as you and I both know, leadership development programs out there. We have a ton of them too. But for people that maybe didn't want to go down that road, we said, you know what? Let's distill even this down. And for people or leadership, I need to get my people to want to play and play to win. There's five behaviors. So we took this from our 13 behaviors of high trust from Stephen M. R. Covey's work on the speed of trust. And we said, out of those 13 behaviors, if people really learned to just demonstrate respect, to listen first, to clarify expectations, to extend trust to others, and practice accountability, that is the 80-20 rule. If we can do that under pressure of all the projects we're dealing with, your people will want to rise to the occasion and want to work with you to play to win.
I'm glad you mentioned that book. I have it on my desk. Stephen M. R. Covey has been my guest, and I'm just an amazing, everything you guys do at Covey is just amazing. I'm going to fangirl all over you because I love the work that you people put out. So can you share some real life stories that illustrate the positive impact observed when individuals implement these practices? Because it sounds easy. It's not. You have to have some people skills. You have to be able to say, okay, everybody, take a break. Let's, breathe a little bit and let's start over. You can't just kind of barge into a room and go, this isn't working, blah, 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 which kind of used to be the case and in some places still is. What are the moves? What do you do when you see people that need to be brought up or brought forward, and other people that just need to be moved somewhere else entirely?
Yeah, great question. And, part of the work, part of my reputation is whenever I talk about this, there is nothing idealistic about this for me. This is hard work. This is real life. You are under pressure. And even for myself, I am all about demonstrating respect. But man, when I'm under pressure, I got to talk to my face, I got to talk to my voice. And I have to take a deep breath because under pressure, I always say it's so much easier to be a bad leader than a good one, right? Just do it because I need you to do it. It's so much easier than
Corner office
restraint.
attitude. That's no longer working. You can't be in the corner office and say, just do what I tell you and nobody gets hurt. That doesn't work.
I know, but it's the human condition, right? It's
It is.
easier. And I allow myself to think that and admit that to myself. So I, it is easier, but I know it doesn't work. And so, or it would have very short-term results. And so you do have to really think about under pressure of the day-to-day, how do I, just stay calm, demonstrate respect? How do I stop and listen and not say, you know what, I don't have time for that, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, all of these things, it's just hard to do. When even clarify expectations, I don't mean clarifying expectations of the project. I mean, I want you to think about a team member. And I see this over and over and over. I'll give you a great example. There's so many people that fit this. Clarify expectations of why their task is important to the project. So when we say, hey, you know, Mary, here, just do this thing. And Mary says, well, what am I doing it for? It's like, don't worry about it. Just do your job. Well, you just made it a job versus taking a minute and saying, let me explain how this task that you're doing fits into the overall project and what it means to the organization. And then you can see that person's eyes go wide. We're like, oh man, I didn't realize that. And you just turned a job, a task, a punch in, punch out into somebody's contribution to something bigger than themselves. And some of these people, Denise, are only taking the job they have because they need a paycheck. That's the other reality of this. It's like, I just need a paycheck. But even with that, and when they think maybe, you know, I don't really care what the mission and vision of the organization is. But when somebody takes the time and says, you know, your task is really part of a bigger thing, and this is how it's affecting our team and the organization, somebody can't help but go, wow, that's, you know, I have some purpose here. And they give more of themselves. So these behaviors look like behaviors your parents taught you. Executing on them and realizing the impact they have is really key. To your point, they don't always go well, and we have to learn about that because we got to practice accountability and make sure that we have everybody moving in the same direction, not thinking that you're just going to be, you know, not paying attention and not caring about are we making progress.
Right. And what you were talking about with, you know, when you're pointing out to somebody, listen, this is not just a heads down on your desk, type up this document and thanks very much. I mean, you're sharing with them that they are important, that they are integrating into the project with the team. But my thinking is listening to you that they probably, once that light bulb moment happens, they probably also get very curious. Where else can I fit in? How else can I help? You know, how can I be creative here? Do you find that?
Yes, in a lot of, you know, again, it's not always 100%, but, and everything you read and, you know, and I'm sure, Denise, you're talking about this with many of your guests, and everything you read is, particularly with the younger generations, you know, that they want to learn, they want to develop. It's necessary for them coming into organizations. They need to see a learning path and they want to be seen. When you see somebody like this and acknowledge them and share how they fit and celebrate the thing, you know, something that they're doing well, they're like, whoa, you know, I mean, we love recognition. We love it as humans. We really enjoy when we're seen and our work is acknowledged, and it creates that word curiosity also has a life of its own in leadership and just in humanness in an organization, because without curiosity, leaders probably shouldn't be leaders, but that's again a conversation for another day. It will create curiosity. It's like, huh, well, if I did that and that felt so good, I've got some other skills in my back pocket. You know, I feel safe enough with this leader that, you know, I want to ask about some other things that I might be able to do. And they start to come out of their shell because trust is being extended to them. And you start to build a wildfire of unleashing talent. And in today's world, and, you know, with the economy the way it is, you know, it's good, you know, but we're still laying off and stuff like that. Organizations have so much human asset in front of them that if they didn't hire somebody else, they could unleash what's right in front of them by doing some of the things, by just implementing these five behaviors and inspiring people to feel good, to feel like they're making progress, and to want to extend even more versus quietly quit.
I love that. Do me a favor and list the five behaviors, if you would, for anybody who might have missed it.
Okay, it's demonstrate respect, listen first, clarify expectations, extend trust, and practice accountability.
And that shouldn't be difficult, but it seems to be difficult.
Well, that's, looks easy, does hard is how we
Yeah,
phrase it. That's what I
I'll
said. Our
write that down.
parents,
Looks
yeah,
easy, does hard.
our parents taught us that, but putting it into practice, like I said, under pressure on the first couple. And then the idea of practice accountability, I can't just let that one go, because when we say that, we have to model that. So if Denise showed up to our meeting late, couple days in a row, our team meeting, our project meeting, and Denise showed up late a couple of days in a row, and I don't say anything, the rest of the team is sitting there going, phew, nothing happened to Denise. So tomorrow, I'm going to take my kids to school, instead of the bus. So you can't let those things go. So you need to be able to hold people accountable and demonstrate respect at the same time, and not call people out in front of the others. And that all is an art and a science. And we go into that in the book, but it's an art and science. And last comment on this for me, the team needs to see you model meeting your commitments. So if you say, Denise, I'm going to get in touch with facilities because I realize you can't do your thing until they respond, and then I don't do that, that's awful. I'm not modeling, then nobody has to be accountable. So I have to go first as the project leader.
Well, and you lose respect and trust. I mean, that's almost instant. If you do it once, okay, you do it another time, it's like people are looking at you sideways.
Yeah, it's and if you've talked to Stephen M. R., who is a dear friend of mine as well, and we just worked together actually on the update to the Speed of Trust. But he, with that, he and his father, Dr. Covey, would say, it takes a long time, it takes work, to build a trust account, and it takes a split second to lose it all.
It does. And I wish, and that's in real life. That's in your personal life. That's you talking to somebody in the grocery store. Be careful. Be proactive. Listen. This is my big gripe with a lot of people. They just don't listen. And that causes a lot of problems.
Listening is not, takes some work. And people will say, no, I'm a good listener, and they're not. Most, and again, our brain, we can blame our brains. It's processing speeds and stuff like that. But it goes back, you said it earlier, Denise, around self-awareness. That to me is the key, is that we become really conscious of how we are showing up and how we are engaging. I mean, this is emotional intelligence, right? It's how am I showing up? How am I managing myself and, to be seen as credible and responsible? And then how am I interacting, with others in a way that's really good and respectful, so I can build a relationship with somebody else? And becoming a good listener is really great, because people say, wow, I just so appreciate, I feel like you really heard what I said.
And I'm a highly committed introvert. Everybody knows this. I don't dislike people. I'm only good around them for about 59 and three quarter minutes, so I get exhausted. But I have to model myself. I can't be a slob in the house and not carry that out with me. So I have to be very aware of who I am and what I'm doing and how I'm speaking to myself and how I'm learning and growing. Because there's nobody here to catch me up and go, Denise, why did you just do that? I have to do that on my own.
Yeah, and we call that the inside out approach. You got to start with yourself first and be very intentional about taking that kind of control, and then you can face the world. And I will match you on the introvert part. And for me, being out there, and people are really shocked when I say that, because I can stand up and I do stand up in front of 10,000 people and have a wonderful few hours of humor and fun and learning. And I'm like you, I'll say, and I'll say to them, okay, and when I'm done with you, I am done. So I get that. I am one of those that can be very happy in my office by myself a lot of the time.
Oh, me too. We talked about that in
Yeah.
the green room. I wanted to ask you, Corey, because one of my favorite chapters is about project management, and I'm on page 144, and it's called the title. The paragraph that I'm reading is the principle of proactivity. Proactivity is one of my favorite things. So this is an important chapter to me. I've got little sticky notes all over it. Talk to us about that, if you would.
Okay. So this chapter is in the process. So, we said value, it's value plus people plus process. And the total process for that we've developed is you got to scope the project, you got to plan the project. If you do those two things well, now the people part comes in where we engage. That's the third step. How do we engage the people with our plan to, be inspired to win? And then the next piece is the projects in motion, track and adapt. So tying this all back to what I said earlier about agile and waterfall, it's how do we go through the project and adjust and course correct as necessary when it's appropriate without getting to scope creep. So that sort of brings us to chapter six of track and adapt, and where we deal with change. Now, humans generally are not great in their first reactions to change. About 85% of people, when hit with a change, will say, "Ugh, that's going to hurt us." And there's always a small percentage that are like, "Oh, woohoo, a change." But it's usually very high, that first reaction to change. So changes will come about with, and you'll see change happening in the stories that are in the book. Changes will come about, and sometimes they're going to be reactive. We have to be reactive to it. Something suddenly happened, and we need to deal with it. On the other hand, and what I know what you're trying to get to here, the principle of proactivity is instead of whether it's working on a project or any part of your life, just waiting for everything to come at you and just fighting things off, how do we go after something to either make it better, to avoid something? And so when it comes to project management, we should be looking as the project managers at the project and saying, okay, what should I be anticipating? What problem, and this is part of the risk management process that we do also. Let me look ahead. Let's brainstorm. What risks do we see, coming up? And let's think about, even how important, let's prioritize them and figure out what's our plan so we don't get hit with it later on. We don't need to be as reactive. So we want to change things when they need to be changed, both, proactively looking ahead for it, and sometimes you're going to get things spontaneously. How do we act on it versus trying to resist all of that in the name of creating value for the project? So we always like to say that things happen to reactive people, and proactive people make things happen. So I like to say it's taking the bull by its horns. And the other thing, Denise, that I'll say about this, just being proactive in life, and it's in the seven habits, it's the first habit because it's so foundational, is when people see you make things happen. And again, not to scope creep, not to make everybody crazy, but done legitimately, people will look at you and go, wow, boy, working with Denise, no matter what happens, she knows how to figure something out. You don't hear her complaining a lot about it, maybe for a sec, but man, and then she's off and running. That's proactivity is so key in being socially, both self-aware, socially aware, and being able to manage people and projects.
Very much so. And I'm scribbling notes as I'm listening to you talk. And, you're talking about bringing people, your stakeholders, kind of all on the same whiteboard, if you will. And I wrote down sales and persuasion.
Yes.
Am
And since
I
I,
understanding it? I think
well,
I
you
am.
said sales and persuasion, correct?
Right, I
Yeah.
did.
Since I, for many years, let's put it there. For many years, I have, I've done, I've taught a t I started in sales. I've taught sales training. You heard me mention neurolinguistics. So I'm all about the brain and all of that. These skills really cross so many, areas, because it is skills of persuasion, of how do you inspire people, and what you're doing is I call it presentation skills, because when I talk about, presentation, it really is, two or more people that are having a discussion in order to learn something or do something different. And it's usually about doing something different. So whether you want somebody to buy something or you want somebody to work differently, it's all about persuasion. Or you want to inspire people to want to play on your team and win. How do I influence them in a great way with a lot of authenticity to do something different? So it's a very big topic.
It is, Corey. And you mentioned something about life. Listen, this book, and frankly, all the books that I've read, that are in my bookcase from Covey, they're not just business books, they're life books. Everything that's in here can start with how you operate day by day in your life. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to be a CEO. You don't have to be a project manager. Although, if you're a mother, a wife, anybody, you're already project managing the heck. I was project managing my cats yesterday. One had to go to the vet, project managed him right into the carrier. He didn't like it, but we did it. We got there. I didn't bleed much, but we are all project managers and we're all living life, in my opinion, as project managers. We might as well get darn good at it.
Yeah, I totally agree, because even, you think about a wedding or a family reunion or Thanksgiving dinner, or all of those things are projects, and we didn't get into the details of the Gantt chart or stuff like that. But when somebody's making dinner, they're doing the project. They know that the turkey's got to go in 4 hours, 4 hours cook time, but I can't put the potatoes in until 10 minutes before the turkey's done. That's called a dependency in the project management world, and we do it intuitively. So the beauty of all this is it is real life. And then all we're doing is identifying those things that we do intuitively, giving it a name, putting a process to it so it's repeatable, so that you can be successful over and over and over again.
Exactly. I wanted to ask you, what are some of the challenges that you've faced along the way doing all of the work that you do, and how have you overcome them? I'm going to go with you're pig-headed, but tell me how you overcome
Well,
them.
I'll take pig-headed, because the story that comes to mind is many years ago now, my previous organization, I had a great couple of, I've been so lucky with the people that I've reported to and have mentored me. But yes, stubbornness, toughness, a mother who told me not to take no for an answer. And, you can, you don't, she said, you don't need to rely on anybody else, which was helpful, but both me and my sisters needed to do a little work with interdependence, because she had us so you could do it. You're three strong women, do it yourself. But really quick, this story, we were implementing ISO 9000 around the world. And I am talking about 25 years ago now. And my CEO kept saying, "Corey, do you need a consultant? Do you need, I'm happy to." I'm like, "No, I've got it." And remember what I said, scarred unofficial project manager. I've got it. And I was going, because he said, you know, when you do a project like this, you know, you're going to, you know, it's all going to come to a head and everything's going to, you know, it's a real critical point. Like, no, I got it. In the meantime, we got to that point and I crashed and burned. And he called, he threatened to fire me, which he didn't. But we spent 12 hours in his office trying to fix the mess I had made. And it was a lesson that I never forgot. And it's caused me to watch my pigheadedness in moving forward. So that's where my initial scar came from with project management. So, you know, it's just being open to learning, counting to 10 for me is really important. And what I said to you before is managing my own demons. When I feel like I
Yeah.
want to be a bad leader or I feel like I know best, all those things, I count to 10 and remember there's other people that do things better and there's a lot of talent around me.
There is, and we don't need to walk away from people because we know they're better at something than we are. We should grab them, hug them, and say, "Help me." You know, I mean, and that's difficult to do. Listen, in my career, the bottleneck was me. Because I just knew everything. And you talk about pigheaded. Oh my God. I mean, I just knew everything and I wanted people to do what I told them and don't offer me any suggestions. Once I figured out that I was actually offending the heck out of my team and they were just kind of, you know, we call it now slow quitting, but they were just drifting off, I went, I am so sorry. I know that, you know, because I hire people who I can do it, but they can do it better. I hire people who are better than I am at one particular, you know, thing that I need in my dev team, and I let them go. It's like, because they're constantly upskilling, they're constantly learning. I'm not. A lot of my knowledge is 10 years old now because I haven't had to keep working in that. I have people.
Yeah, and it takes a really good leader with good character to be able to do that because it's gotten better out there, but there's still leaders out there that I'm the smartest one in the room and I'm not going to hire anybody that's a threat to that. And that's unfortunate. And I think a lot of people, I think we've moved. I was just talking about this with some of my peers yesterday. I think we've moved from that. You know, a bit where I think most leaders realize that their people are the key to moving the business forward and that they should step back a bit in good leadership. But we don't have enough of it yet.
We'll get there. If
We
people,
will.
you know, if they'll learn and get out of their own way, consciously learn and get out of their own way, you know, you really don't have to stay stuck all the time. Corey, before I let you go, where can people, let me say this, I really appreciate your company today and thank you for the book. And spending time with you has been a distinct pleasure. And I love talking with other pig-headed women. So I think you figured that out. Would you mind sharing your online presence and your preferred means of contact for those who wish to learn more about you? And where can they find the book?
Thank you for asking. So, first of all, the book is at any of the booksellers. And then when you click in, you'll probably see the original version from 2015 and the new version, you know, nearby. So just make sure you get what you want. They all have great stories. So if you get both, that's fine too. As well, you can go to www.franklincovey.com and you'll see an array of books and our courses and all of that. So lots of opportunities to get to the book. And then for me, you can find me on LinkedIn and Facebook in particular, and happy to connect and happy to answer anybody's questions. So appreciate you asking that, Denise. And it really also has been just a great pleasure having this discussion with you, and the time just flew by. So thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And listen, anytime you want to come back, you just let me know. You are welcome anytime.
You.
Listen to our audience as we conclude today's episode. Your feedback means a lot. So if you found the show helpful, please support us with a quick review on iTunes. Your input is vital in my mission to inspire and empower more individuals. So don't forget forget to hit subscribe, leave a review, and share your Partner in Success Radio with friends and colleagues. And be sure to go find Corey Kogan on the web and connect with her and get these books. If you have an entrepreneurial library, add them, read them, bookmark them. If you don't have an entrepreneurial library, what are you waiting for? Thank you, everybody, and I will see you next week.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.